Tax law was her first language. Hebrew was her second. English was her third. So Daphna taught me the intricacies of tax law, and I helped her with her writing. She was born and raised in Tel Aviv, so she also showed me and some of the other suburbanites how to enjoy city living. Thanks to her, we went out after work to the best restaurants, the hottest clubs, the latest shows. When I was disappointed that a senior partner was hosting yet another all-male event, Daphna and I organized our own steak dinner. We realized during our first year as lawyers that dating in New York was hard, and our jobs didn't make it any easier. There were no role models in our vicinity for women who had both families and thriving careers. Most of the few women I encountered were single. One high-powered lawyer, often held up as the exemplar of a woman who had it all, once took a call during a meeting from her son, wailing on speakerphone because she was missing his 10th birthday party. Chilling. Over dinner one night, Daphna and I together confronted the fact that we could end up single. We were in our mid-20s, and there seemed a growing likelihood we would not find men we wanted to marry. So we made a pact to have kids on our own if we were still single at 35, and a promise to take off an hour here or there for our children's birthday parties. We didn't think about how we would make it work, but we vowed to try. Meanwhile, I had developed a profound fear of missing out on what was happening in the world of tech. Out in California, the tech boom was in full force, and I eagerly followed news of its growth. Netscape had its IPO, the internet was exploding, and learning and communications were forever changed. The legal world was way behind the curve. At the law firm, we used hand-labeled disks for each deal. Partners called computers machines. They were used by operators. The first time someone asked me if I knew how to use a machine, I was confused and answered no. I had no idea he meant typing and editing a document on a computer. My breaking point came when a partner I worked with changed the same section of a document over and over again, for what seemed to me to be no reason at all. On the third round, I asked him why. His cheerful reply, "Change for change's sake." As much as I liked learning and my lawyer friends, I knew it was time for me to get out of law. If I went back to tech, I thought, I could be part of the exciting changes I'd been seeing from afar. I was thrilled, too, by the prospect of never having to see the inside of a lawyer's office, with all its piles of paper, again. Chapter 4. Harvard Business School. In the mid-1990s, Netscape was the beacon of change. When it went public on August 9, 1995, only 16 months after it was founded, it was valued at $2.9 billion. After that, even non-tech people realized that the web was the future. Out in California, a new sort of gold rush was starting. Creative, brilliant people were walking into lampposts while scribbling down ideas. Their eyes lit up, and they talked excitedly over coffees and lunches about their inventions. New products were the priority. People strove to change the world. Silicon Valley was moving, and you could almost feel the ground shake. My plan was to head to San Francisco, but I knew I had a lot of catching up to do before I could hope to make it there. I decided to make my way west via the Northeast, where I would do 2 years of business school. My older sister had gotten her MBA at Harvard, and I was excited to follow her lead, using a business degree as a stepping stone to a future in tech. Leaving law and heading back to school was a last-minute decision, so I only applied to Harvard, the one business school that I knew didn't require the GMAT. Happily, I got in, and right away I loved it. It was great to be out of law and back to a world where people were energetic and optimistic. My classmates and I collaborated on team projects and in study groups. We were learning about entrepreneurship and meeting compelling leaders in tech and business. Here were people who had actually built companies and had so much to teach us about creating products and leading teams. My real estate professor had founded an early and admired investment fund. My leadership professor was on the Rockefeller Foundation board of directors and had helpful advice on how to lead as an introvert and woman of color. My finance professor had turned around an otherwise unexciting manufacturing business, shoe trees, and helped us understand how to read the numbers with operations in mind. I loved looking at problems from all different angles, understanding the financial, operational, strategic, and interpersonal aspects of a range of businesses. I was learning a lot and making friends at Harvard and in tech, though I was also starting to notice some limits. Harvard Business School was paying a lot of lip service to diversity and inclusion. They were embarrassed by how few women were in my class. At 24%, it was the lowest percentage in 15 years. Once in a while, though, you'd witness a certain lack of worldliness. Some guffawing guys got caught passing around a pink dildo during class, mistakenly thinking that being in the top row, or sky deck, gave them carte blanche to act like 12-year-olds. The school administration had a formal discussion with our whole section about the inappropriateness of the behavior. The perpetrators seemed more offended than enlightened, and they petulantly recounted the story afterward to anyone who would listen. The dildo episode confused me. What was so hysterically funny about the mere presence of a sex toy? And why was the student's response to being scolded not embarrassment, but rather moral outrage and advanced placement sulking? There was some awareness back then about hidden gender bias, particularly because of research like the famous Howard and Heidi study. Two Columbia Business School professors had taken an HBS case study about a female venture capitalist named Heidi Roizen, and, in half the classes they taught, presented exactly the same stories and qualifications but called her Howard. In surveys of the students, they came away believing that Howard was beloved, so competent, such a go-getter, whereas Heidi was a power-hungry egomaniac. Same person, just a different name. To their credit, some of my HBS professors worked to eliminate their own bias from the classroom. A big part of our grades came from participation, but women, people of color, and international students often weren't called on, or the professors would forget they'd spoken. So some professors would bring in an outsider to keep track of who spoke. They could use that record rather than their own, perhaps faulty, memory. At the end of my first year, my study group had 10 or 11 men, plus me. They were friendly enough, but at the end of the year, all the men, including several unofficial group members, were invited in a massive email to a study group celebration. And I was overlooked. I had heard about the event because I was a girlfriend at that point. My boyfriend was a popular member of the group. I knew it was an oversight, and I didn't bring it up. Instead, I ended up going, excited to celebrate the end of the year with friends. But I do remember my feeling of sadness at not being included. Over time, I found my crew, a diverse and interesting bunch of students. We worked on projects together, drove to see the leaves change in the fall, shared class notes, and had fun. I loved learning about my new friends' varied experiences, working in Japan and Turkey, winning Olympic gold, playing for the Colorado Rockies, hiring for a 5-star hotel, you name it. Their negative work experiences, too, were instructive. One told me what it was like firing teams of people repeatedly as a private equity investor. Another had a job offer revoked after revealing a pregnancy. Another told me about how his employer would let people know they'd been fired by boxing up their belongings and stacking them in a hallway. My first study group had been almost all Asian. It was the first time since Chinese language and culture school that I'd spent a lot of time hanging out with people who were born or lived in Asia at some point in their lives. I thought of Harvard Business School as an institution that valued diversity, even if some of my immature classmates devalued it. The administration talked about bringing in more women, expressing dismay at the low percentage of women who matriculated. Later, I would come to see that the school's track record for helping women, in particular, to succeed was indeed a disgrace. 5 years after graduation, someone told me 75% of the women in my business school class had stopped working. A decade after that, the New York Times ran a magazine cover story on HBS's gender problems, describing the school's gender grade gap as a dirty secret. Even women on the faculty were not immune. Harvard lost a third of its junior women professors in 1 year. 5 months later, the dean of the business school was compelled to apologize publicly for the school's treatment of women, who at times, he acknowledged, felt disrespected, left out, and unloved by the school. At the time, I wasn't privy to or aware of much of what was happening, but a well-reported feature in Inc. magazine from 1998, the year I graduated, described Harvard Business School's frat house atmosphere in detail. The story also showed the impact one top institution's culture can have, suggesting that it contributed to a major drop in female graduates, meaning a major drop in top-flight female MBAs in the country, ultimately meaning a major drop in the number of women in positions of power at American companies. Among the incidents described by that article, male students passed female students and visitors notes saying things like, "Come over here so I can lick you." A student newspaper's April Fool's issue described Harvard's attempts at recruiting more women. Courses like Sleeping Your Way to the Top, PMS Best Practices Management, and Addressing the Does This Make Me Look Fat? Question. One line in the article. "Jesus H. Christ, the last thing HBS needs is more whiny, self-absorbed, politically correct, premenstrual, prissy crybabies who can't take a friggin' joke, even if it is shoved down their friggin' throat." And a student-produced handbook sent to incoming first-year students included dating advice like, "Think globally and penetrate locally." Can you imagine getting that handbook as a high-achieving college woman or business leader? Looking back, I recall elements of that culture. But honestly, I just thought there were a few men who were really immature, with lousy senses of humor, and I avoided them. I felt happy with my HBS experience, and proud of having picked up another discipline. 95% of my experiences were positive. I'd made good friends and learned a lot. And I'd fallen in love. He was an investment banker in Hong Kong and a couple of years younger than me. Mutual friends had introduced us, telling me, "This guy is a finance whiz." We met just before business school and joined the same study group. He was sweet, loyal, and dependable, and super smart. He also shared a love of hard work. He was obsessed with playing basketball, and I noticed that he was always trying to improve. If he met a better player, he'd pummel him with questions like, "What kind of exercises improved your vertical leap?" But he was also very grounded. His parents had founded a biotech company and so they were well off, but they lived a very simple life. He grew up in San Francisco and was socially liberal, but in his own life he was very conservative and risk-averse. He liked stability and long-term plans. He was considerate and never tried to take advantage of anyone. He wanted us to do everything together, and that was just fine with me. We had been happily dating for a year and a half when he proposed in front of one of the big buildings at Harvard by the Charles River. He picked that spot, he said, because he knew it would be there forever. He had talked to my mom first. My mom loved him, and he loved her. We got married on Cape Cod soon after graduation, with just our families in attendance. We flew to Hawaii for our honeymoon, and a hilarious, hyper-informed friend of ours who grew up there helped us plan a trip to every island. He and a golfing buddy of his went with us for some of it, and they'd take us to get curry bowls at out-of-the-way spots. We did a lot of snorkeling while our friends played what felt like every golf course on the islands. When we got back to the mainland, we were excited to start our new lives. We had received phenomenally good educations, and we were young, ambitious, and bursting with energy. There seemed to be no limit to what we could achieve. We had driven across the country to San Francisco to become part of the dot-com boom, enthralled by the opportunity to build products that could transform how people live. I was excited to recapture my childhood love of technology. I had studied hard and worked hard to get here. I was making my family proud. And I had the sense that my life was truly beginning. Part 2. Starting up in Silicon Valley. Chapter 5. Startup City. Silicon Valley. The venture capital and tech startup center of the world. Spreads across the peninsula southeast of San Francisco, up through the city, and across the Bay Bridge to the East Bay. Much of the area was once an orchard, teeming with apricots and nuts. Known best for the export of prunes, its prior nickname was Valley of Heart's Delight. I arrived here in 1998, long after tech companies had taken over from the early aerospace developers who'd pushed out the farmers in the 1940s. The valley I entered was an army of earnest engineers who valued nonstop work and saw limitless opportunities for revolutionizing the world. I would eventually find my way into the world of venture capital, but first I paid my dues in a series of tech businesses ranging from startups to bigger companies. The startup culture of Silicon Valley can seem mysterious and confusing to those outside it. People build their careers by moving around frequently. Partly because companies work hard to poach talent, and partly because many people fall in love with the next shiny new thing. Fluidity here is normal and expected. Even a sign of success. Most people are transplants, drawn to Silicon Valley for the work. The culture is built on a foundation of restlessness and change. The endless push to iterate, improve, innovate, and revolutionize. My first job out of business school was at Web TV, which I loved in spite of its conflicts and inconsistencies. The startup was involved in both hardware and software, and the founders had this crazy-for-the-time idea that we could use the internet in the living room, displayed on our television screens. Back then, PCs were mostly for the office. The few in homes were task-oriented. Web TV was a whole new way of using a computer. From your couch, not your desk, and for play, not work. About 400 employees were working there when I started, and the three co-founders were creative, smart, and professional. Two of them shared an office, even long after they sold the company to Microsoft for almost $500 million. They had all worked together at Apple, and two of the founders were married with kids, which perhaps helped explain their gift for allowing people to find relative work-life balance. The most wild event during my time there was when the founders hired UB40 to headline our holiday party at the Warfield in San Francisco. As part of Microsoft, Web TV was a calm and stable place to work compared with today's startups. At the time, it felt like an environment where different types of people did well. Looking back, though, I don't think I worked with a single Latinx or black employee the whole time I was there. The three co-founders were white men. Most of the managers were too. My group, business development, had three women in it, including one manager. To me, at the entry level, it seemed fine and fair enough. When I started, the mission of my project was to give every home in Singapore a Web TV set-top box. It was a grand $250 million experiment. Web TV would provide high-speed interactive access to informative content, entertainment, you name it. We partnered with the island state's main broadband internet company as they supplied fiber connectivity to every home. We were touting the educational potential of Web TV to our partners in Singapore, while also trying to attract media attention in the United States. My memory is that it never quite recovered after a splashy U.S. announcement of our partnership with the TV show Baywatch offended the conservative sensibilities of the Singaporeans. Microsoft had bought Web TV just after I signed on. And while I was there, the Microsoft culture started to clash with the Sun and Apple culture of the key executives. The upside was that people were expected to be very direct with one another, thanks to Microsoft's open culture. Conflicts were resolved via a clearly defined hierarchy. If we were arguing because I wanted to take our product into schools first and you wanted to go into hospitals, we would go up the chain of command until we reached someone who managed the two of us. Perhaps a vice president. And that person would make the call. And we would go forward under that decision together. It wasn't viewed as personal, and most of us didn't take it that way. There was, of course, resistance to Microsoft, especially at the founder level. WebTV's CEO hadn't wanted to sell the company. It was the only way he could make payroll and stave off bankruptcy. So there was friction. And, being Microsoft, the conflicts were direct. One Microsoft engineering leader said to a colleague, "I don't care if Bill effing Gates walks through my door right now and tells me to do it your way. I'd quit first." He's now a professional rock musician. I had a manager I got along with, but who I can now see was kind of a jerk. The first time I really noticed that it was more than just random was the day I recommended a super qualified friend of mine for an interview. "That's a Korean name, isn't it?" my boss said. I said it was. "Have you ever worked with Korean people before?" I didn't know where this was going, but I knew it was probably nowhere good. We were working in business development for Asia, and here he was about to stereotype a national population. The best I could hope for was that he would say something like, "They sure do like their coleslaw spicy." Alas, no. "They're really lazy," my boss said. "It's hard to get them to work." I pushed back awkwardly. "Well, the hardest working person I've ever known was Korean," I said, referencing Esther from my law firm. "I think you're wrong, and I know my friend would be great at this job." We never found out, because, no surprise, he didn't get it. This boss had made it clear that he didn't trust Asian people, so perhaps I should have expected him to pour through my expenses line by line and question every receipt. It was ridiculous. I'm a rule follower, and extremely conservative with what I expense. I go by the book. If I misplace or forget a receipt, I don't try to submit it, even if I could. He didn't go through anyone else's receipts. Just mine. After I left, a male coworker bragged to me about what huge expenses he was able to push through that boss without a second look. I also probably shouldn't have been surprised by my rating in my first review. Microsoft required managers to slot employees along a forced curve, with a certain percentage of employees in each category. Below average, average, and above average. My manager had slotted me in the slightly above average group. But I was bewildered. I had never been in less than the top category, and I asked him what I could have done better as I listed my accomplishments. He had no answer. I think he assumed I would passively and meekly accept the rating without question. He was frustrated and defensive, but in the next round, he gave me the highest ratings. It was the only time I had spoken up. When he had work to do, I would do it even if it meant pulling an all-nighter. Sometimes he made me stay late, calling for meetings at 9 or 9:30 p.m., when we were the only people left in the office. After these meetings, he would occasionally show me art, including art with nudity in it, which just made me impatient. "We're here to work, not to look at pictures," I'd think, backing away from his desk. I don't believe he was trying to be malicious or creepy. He just seemed dorky and awkward and probably a little lonely. I would meet a lot of guys like him in the years to come. The next tech startup I worked for was called Tellme, which was an early version of Siri or Alexa. We described it as Dial Tone 2.0, the future of the phone, only probably a decade too early. I joined when it was small, mostly friends of the founders from Netscape and Microsoft. When I interviewed, I met with every employee in a single evening, from 5 p.m. to midnight, and they gave me an offer before I left that night. I was impressed that the 6-person engineering team had 2 black men and 1 Asian woman. I took a huge pay cut and title cut to join, confident that I would prove myself worthy of a promised quick promotion. During my first week, I put together a demo of the product, an interactive joke line with speech recognition software. "Do you want to hear some funny stuff?" Tellme would ask when you called. If you said yes, you would hear a recording of an Onion satirical report about how Bill Gates, in his seemingly unstoppable takeover of America, was on his way to getting half of everything in the country. In the snippet, a fake Gates says, "Ice cream and cool cars are part of my half." Then the app asked, "Do you want to hear some more?" And if the person said yes, another funny Onion clip would play. It was short, but it showed the power of audio and speech recognition. And people loved using it for demos so much that I had to keep updating it every time we changed servers or flavors of programming language. Even if I was on the phone or on the road to close deals, someone would interrupt and say, "Please rewrite this in VXML before my meeting." It was a little stressful, but flattering too. In these meetings, I found it pretty funny to hear them trying to sell our product as the easiest thing in the world to program, using my demo app as their example. "This is by Ellen," they'd say, pointing me out. "Our business development person. See how easy it is? Even our business development person can do it." I would say, "Well, it's not that easy. I can program in 5 languages. I have an electrical engineering degree." "It's so easy, your mom can do it." Well, I'd think, my mom has a PhD in computer science, so she could, but so easy. My main job was trying to bring great audio content to the site, so anyone could ask for interesting information and get an immediate answer in customized, high-quality audio instead of a robot voice. There was no other easy source of voice interaction at the time, so we had to find content, package it, organize it, and program it into our product. Then, when you called, you could get the latest sports scores, stock quotes, weather forecasts, news headlines, traffic updates, restaurant recommendations, and more. There were 20 of us at the company, and I was making 10 to 20 cold calls a day, trying to convince big brands like Zagat, CNN, and Westwood One to take a bet on us with their crown jewel content. My pitch highlighted 3 of our top investors: Jim Barksdale, former CEO of Netscape and AT&T Wireless, Ram Shriram, a former executive at Amazon and Netscape, and John Doerr of the legendary venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins, who was treated like a rock star each time he visited Tellme in person. 2 of these men had been early investors in Google, I said, and now they were early investors in Tellme. So, sometimes it worked. Other times I had to call again and again, almost stalking people, until they made the mistake of answering. Nina Zagat picked up her office phone at midnight, which became the start of our Tellme Zagat partnership. And it was funny that I later worked for John, because at Tellme I said his name over and over again every day on phone calls. The Tellme culture was great. The sales team was a little aggressive, and there was one guy always trying to hit on the women in the office, but otherwise it was awesome, to use the CEO's favorite adjective. For fun, sometimes we played Grab's Grab, a game one of the founders had invented. It was like Scrabble on steroids. You had to be fast, see patterns, have a good vocabulary, and get lucky with tiles. So it wasn't always clear who would win. You really got to know people by how they played that game. One of the most introverted engineers at Tellme wowed us repeatedly with obscure and creative words. and the guy who invented the game would almost always call the same patterns. He was so fast and frequent at calling them that we would all curse, "Effing hottie!" when he did it. He just laughed and called them out faster. It was a great group of people, and we enjoyed our time together. Then a new VP came in and dumbed down the culture. He informed me during a search for new employees that he was looking for single men who were willing to travel. As he built out his team, I saw him bring in 23 young white men and one Asian woman to interview.
"Did you see how I made her sit on that beanbag chair in her short skirt?"
he bragged later of the lone female applicant. Another time, I overheard him shout to a coworker as he left the building,
"I hope you close that deal tonight."
"Oh, what deal?" I asked.
"There's no deal," he replied brusquely. "He has a date."
Meanwhile, my marriage was happy, even though we didn't get much quality time together. He wasn't thrilled at my spending so much time in Palo Alto and later in Mountain View, when the office moved even farther south. We were both working really hard. Even when the bubble burst in 2000, we were doing fine. We were earning money, more than we needed, saving up to buy a place to live. And we had friends in the city from work and school. We found time together when we could. I would drive him to work early and then drive back the other way to my job. He liked being taken care of, and he was a creature of habit. Every morning, I would drop him off at the same restaurant so he could get himself the same breakfast burrito at the same time on his way into the office. Intellectually and professionally, we were very compatible, and we were fascinated by each other's jobs. I was at early-stage companies, and he was investing in late-stage ones. He'd be talking to Carly Fiorina of HP, and I'd be talking to young startup entrepreneurs. We had a front-row seat to the way the culture of Silicon Valley was changing, and we discussed it the way you would a favorite sports team, cringing at what we saw as botched plays and cheering at hits. Also, we were shocked by the amount of money changing hands and by what it did to people. A lot of college kids were striking gold with their startups. Suddenly they had tons of cash and power over other people. No one would tell them no, because people wanted them to be free, to be creative, to run the world. They were working with their friends, living together or close to one another. Until 2008, Facebook offered a $600 per month subsidy for living within a mile of the office. When, years later, Google said they were thinking about building employee housing to address astronomical rents and real estate prices, I flashed back to the dorm lifestyle that Facebook subsidy had provoked and wondered if it would work out better this time around. Or at least better than the company towns of the late 1800s and early 1900s. The rise of the frat bro startup culture in the 2000s led the tech world to ignore a lot of best practices already well known in the rest of the business world. Tech could have learned from other industries' experiences. Instead, it gave very little weight to what any other industry could contribute, because techies viewed themselves as disruptors. There's often a hubris in tech. We'll do it right this time. There's also a popular term at startups, NIH, for not invented here. That resistance to relying on other people's work came heavily from Apple. Steve Jobs wanted everything to be proprietary, so he could own and control it, and charge for it. That context has dissolved a little bit. These days, products are so complex that there's often too much tech for one company to manage. But there's still a little of that mentality. We can reinvent everything. To me, that sometimes seemed like change for change's sake, taken to the extreme. As the world shifted around us, my husband and I had each other's backs. I'd done a stint at a management consulting firm, where they taught us how to master presentations and messaging. I'd help him improve his presentations to investors or to his colleagues. We'd work on his pitches until they gleamed. To be fair, this was the dry world of money management.
Given the audience's low expectations, those presentations came across as the equivalent of a Beyoncé concert. But it wasn't all work. For fun, we played video games together, shutting all the shades and playing Doom until I got nauseated. And he loved sports and was a loyal fan, so we often had a Yankees or Steelers or Bulls game on. Lee enjoyed the outdoors. We hiked a lot, and I learned to play tennis and to ski. And we loved all the food options in California. Back then, San Francisco wasn't as expensive and crowded as it later got to be. You could go to nice restaurants, and it wasn't a crazy mob scene. Similarly, our coworkers might go to Burning Man, but they weren't going with an army of Sherpas like you see today. It was more casual and hippie-ish than calculated or hipster. You could wear jeans to a fancy restaurant, and people would assume you were a tech person who didn't know better. Back then, the farmers market was low-key, trafficking mostly to chefs and bohemians, and operated out of a parking lot on Saturday mornings that had been transformed from Friday night's disco roller skating rink. Outside the city, you could take a day trip to the ski slopes of Sugar Bowl or North Star, the ocean at Stinson Beach or Point Reyes, the hiking trails at Muir Woods or Big Sur, or the wineries at Healdsburg or Sonoma. And it was pretty much always sunny and 70 degrees. California felt like heaven. My happiness, financial security, and stability at home gave me the freedom to keep an eye out for promising new opportunities. I was not loving the beanbag chair VP, and when I thought it was clear that I wasn't going to get a promotion or a raise, I became very frustrated. Why weren't they moving me up, as they had promised to after a trial period? I had closed 16 deals in 9 months, navigating big corporations' bureaucracies on behalf of our experimental programs and solving prickly implementation issues. I understood that they were distracted. The startup was moving from targeting consumers to building automated customer support lines for big companies. And when they had a layoff, a few of the fired employees learned they'd been terminated only when they couldn't log into their work accounts. Even though the stock market had taken a nosedive, TellMe had smartly raised way more than enough cash. Still, everything they did gave me the indication that I wasn't going to be able to succeed there. And so I gave notice and resigned, even though I had no new job waiting for me. Right away, I was astonished to find that they wanted to keep me and help me succeed. They offered me a 50% raise, and the CEO asked me to have lunch with him once a week. It was everything I'd hoped for. They acknowledged and praised my contributions. They were going to adjust my compensation. As a bonus, I would have more direct access to the CEO, which meant he valued me and my work. He was an actual product and technology visionary. But I was more stubborn then. And even this tidal wave of opportunity didn't undo the months of what felt to me like disrespect. In retrospect, I probably would have done well if I had stayed. The CEO's attention would have been especially valuable, both personally and professionally. But by then, I'd soured on the situation and just couldn't get over it. And so I left. But before I did, knowing I had nothing to lose, I let the HR person know about the inappropriate comments and behavior. Her response was to push me to sign an agreement not to sue, falsely claiming every departing employee had to sign one. That was my first taste of crappy HR. Luckily, right around that time, I heard that Andy Rubin was starting a company. At WebTV, I'd heard his name often. Andy was known for building whatever he wanted, like a kid. He had wired up a robot to wander the halls of WebTV with a camera that broadcast to a cable station. This was in 2000, years before wireless cameras and YouTube. Andy and another WebTV alum, Joe Britt, who was often found carrying his pet rat on his shoulder, were legendary as engineering wizards. And so when Andy and Joe unveiled a website for a new technology startup called Danger Research, I took notice. It had a cool animated graphic by a designer named Matias Duarte. A girl would walk down the street, turn the corner, and suddenly the word danger would flash on screen. Their logo looked like a chemical symbol. Who knew what any of that meant? Were they going to build a new internet box or something completely different? I didn't care. If it was Andy and Joe, I knew it would be interesting. I emailed Andy and asked if there was any way I could help. He had me come in, and I became a consultant. The team was small, only about a dozen people. The first thing I noticed was that everyone was calm in personality and intense about work quality. The office music set the culture. Mellow, but not mainstream. Engaging, but not overbearing. I can't remember who the office DJ was, but he introduced me to the Chemical Brothers. Not stuff I usually listened to, but it gave the office a relaxed, happy vibe. It wasn't just the music. People put a lot of thought into every element of that workplace. For example, there was always candy on hand. One day, I found myself talking to the young engineer who had taken it upon himself to order the candy every week. "What's the most popular kind?" I asked, picking through the shelves, looking for a 100 grand bar. "It really depends," he said. Excited, he explained the candy supply and demand of the office in great detail, including the hoarding that happened when stock was low. I wouldn't have been surprised if he'd broken out a spreadsheet and some graphs. I loved that. He was paying so much attention to what people were doing and what they wanted. And if I hadn't asked, he never would have told me about it. There was such an earnestness to him and everyone else at Danger. The candy engineer once competed in a battle of the bands and emailed us, asking if we would consider voting for his group and including a link to the contest website. "Why don't you send the link straight to your page rather than to the main page?" I said after opening the email. "But I want to give everyone the chance to pick whoever they like," he replied. "What if they like another band better?" "Everyone's going to vote for you," I said. "I only want them to if they think I'm the best," he said. I found that endearing, and indicative of the humility and earnestness I saw in so many of the team. While I was hired at Danger as a part-time business development consultant, I started out helping them with fundraising pitches. I didn't have any equity and wasn't a full member of the team, but I liked that fine. Next, I took on my first product role to help them put together their spec for their first product, which eventually launched as the first personal phone with a mobile web browser, texting, a calendar, and email, and the first app marketplace. The BlackBerry was out, but only had work email. Called the Hip Top, eventually renamed the Sidekick, the Danger phone had music, games, all kinds of personal apps. Web TV had transformed the work PC into a social device for personal use, and Danger was going to do the same for the mobile phone. I stayed until they got funding, and then I left. There could be no business development until there was a product, and that would take at least 6 more months. I was going to miss the team, its DJ playlist, the carefully managed snack shelf, and even the rat. A few years later, after the product shipped, Danger was bought by Microsoft for a reported $500 million. A friend from Telmeet connected me with another John Doerr Kleiner-backed startup, My CFO, which also hired me as a consultant. It was started before online banking was big, when it was still hard to figure out where all your money was if you were super wealthy. My CFO allowed you to track your wealth via a dashboard, and you had a quarterback who was always available to help you read the dashboard. He or she could also tell you what it meant to your finances if the market dropped or if gold went up. The quarterback could calculate the value of your assets in exact dollars across all your banks and investments and quickly come up with a tailored plan in response. One of the things we had to figure out early on was how fast the quarterback and dashboard would have to respond to clients. To help us decide, a member of the team asked, "How mad would Jim get if he had to wait for a callback?" Jim Clark was our CEO, the former co-founder of Netscape and Silicon Graphics, Inc., and he supposedly had a bad temper. I never saw it, but no one wanted to see it either. We decided he wouldn't be able to wait more than an hour before he started to yell. And that was our answer. Every partner we worked with had to be able to fix any noticeable problem within about an hour. Our team at My CFO was pretty diverse. My manager was a black engineer. His manager was a woman mathematician. And my partner on the team doing business development was another woman. The serious, focused culture of the team and its lack of drama, and my part-time role, kept me happy and productive. Ultimately, though, there weren't enough clients who had that much money and wanted that information delivered in just that way, 1 hour time limit or not. And the company was bought by a boutique bank after I left. But I'd learned a lot, and I was intrigued by my stint in the financial services world. In 2001, I decided to go back to full-time work, and I joined BEA Systems, a software company. That was another mostly good culture, though there was a lot of turnover. I was there for 4 years and had 8 different managers. I had one boss twice. I was reminded yet again that the culture, good or bad, makes a difference. 3 years after both companies were founded, BEA had bought WebLogic, a startup that became the engine of the merged company. WebLogic was still really small and scrappy, mostly male. The integration between the corporate company and the startup had been rough at times. Once WebLogic was acquired, the new CTO realized that the WebLogic team was using a lot of bandwidth on the internet, slowing down operations and racking up costs. He sent her out an email saying, "To the person who's using so much internet bandwidth, you know who you are and you need to stop." No one ever revealed to him that the heavy user was a porn server someone at the startup had built, which optimized downloading and sharing clips among his friends at the office. The employee's porn hobby seemed dopey to me, but not terrible. I think the earnestness of most of the people in those days smoothed over the tackiness of things like the porn server, which in any event was shut down long before I joined the company. And a lot of my bosses were terrific. A standout was my 6th and 8th boss there, Peter Cooper Ellis. On my first day working for him, he and I went to meet with a backer of a company we wanted to partner with. The backer was a billionaire Texan founder turned investor. And in the meeting, he started talking only to me. He was bragging about a baseball team he owned and saying to me, with what seemed like a little too much intensity, "Come down and I'll take you to a game." "My husband loves baseball," I said.
"My wife doesn't," he replied. "She's a librarian. We've been together a long time."
The whole meeting, he kept talking about getting together and making not so thinly veiled references to an open marriage. I didn't know anyone in an open marriage at the time, so I wasn't really sure what he was talking about and just tried to keep the conversation light and positive. "Yes," I said, "we should all go to a baseball game. The whole team. What a treat." But he kept asking to spend time with me alone, and I kept trying to believe he wasn't. On the flight back, Peter cleared the air, saying,
"I'm sorry about that, Ellen. I should have said something to him about how inappropriate he was when he was hitting on you. I should have stepped in."
I was surprised. For one thing, I was a little embarrassed to hear that he had noticed, and relieved that he thought it was wrong. One thing that can make a job lonely is to feel as if no one sees what you see. I could imagine another boss saying, "What's the problem? The guy just wanted to take you to a baseball game." Or pretending nothing had happened. I reassured Peter that it was no big deal and that it hadn't occurred to me that he should or would jump in to put a stop to it. I figured I'd handled it on my own just fine. I wasn't expecting to be rescued. We joked about the ridiculousness of the conversation. "Yes, let's take everyone to a baseball game. And several people can sit between us." No serious harm was done by the flirty CEO. On the contrary, I was grateful to learn that my boss had picked up on what was happening and was willing to acknowledge the inappropriateness of it all. I loved working for Peter.
All of us on his team worked so well together to help the company succeed, including stars like Mikey Butler, now SVP of Engineering at New Relic, and Scott Dietzen, CEO of Pure Storage, a public tech company. Peter was a hard worker, and he prioritized his work commitments, but also had a large family. I was amazed at how often he flew back and forth between San Francisco and Vermont, where his wife and four kids lived. He ran the best staff meetings because he built a supportive, collaborative culture. Everyone had a clear role. We were set up to succeed, and he encouraged us to help one another. At meetings, we went around the room and talked about where we needed help and problem-solved together. We were super focused and productive. Later, we had to unravel a partnership with the company of the amorous Texan investor, who was also a board member. By that point, a group of us from San Francisco were driving down to San Jose every day to take over another team's Skunkworks project. Skunkworks is not exactly Black Ops. It was still an approved BEA project, but it meant they were building something outside traditional channels and resources. Business school made Skunkworks projects sound more glamorous by calling them Tiger Teams, when really it just meant a small team doing something that could become really big but not getting the people or the money to do it right. Once this Skunkworks team got the product up and running, we were sent in to redo it to fit in the bigger organization. For me, that meant renegotiating deals the Skunkworks team had signed, including a deal to license this Texas company's technology in exchange for a big share of our revenue. When the product looked like it was going to do well, we thought, oh no, we can't give away that much revenue. We wanted to renegotiate the royalty, but we had no standing or leverage. To make matters worse, the Texas company was going out of business right as we were negotiating new terms, and we didn't know what was going to happen to it or to our deal. It was another worst-case scenario. I kept calling and calling, hoping I'd get someone sympathetic on the phone. They had filed for bankruptcy and weren't even picking up the phone, much less returning voicemail messages. I just wanted to get us out of the deal, but I had nothing to offer. There's an expression I love that my BEA colleague Mikey uses to let people know that they need to focus and prioritize. The house is on fire, and you're changing the drapes. The situation here was even worse. Essentially, their house had burned down, and I was trying to get them to give me a refund for the drapes. As a kind of Hail Mary pass, I flew down to Texas. I think they thought I was bluffing about my trip when they finally agreed to schedule a meeting time, because they weren't available when I got there. I could see lawyers and accountants going in and out of offices, wearing gloomy dark suits and somber expressions. I wondered if I should have brought a floral wreath. My expectations were low, but I thought if I could get in front of the VP, I had a chance to convince him that they had nothing to lose by agreeing to terminate our pre-bankruptcy agreement. But of course, they could also clearly see that they had nothing to gain. So I sat in the lobby waiting for a miracle as the VP's assistant urged me to go home. Then, suddenly, the billionaire baseball team owner appeared. "Alan, what brings you here?" he said brightly. "Well, it's funny you ask," I said. "I've been waiting for a meeting that was scheduled to start a few hours ago, and I don't know if they're ever going to see me. I need to amend this contract. If someone will just sign this document, I can head back to San Francisco."
"This document?"
he said, holding up the two pages that would amend the royalties contract. He disappeared and came back minutes later with a signature. Like some kind of startup magician. I thanked him. He said I was welcome. And then he didn't ask me out for a drink or to a baseball game or anything. He just did a professional kindness with no attempt to benefit. It could have just as easily gone the other way, with him being peeved at me for dodging his advances the first time or thinking I owed him something now. But instead he was kind and decent. The main emotion he seemed to show was surprise, though, to this day, I'm not sure whether the source of his wonderment was that I had the nerve to ask a down-on-its-luck company for a favor, or that I was looking for a signature on a totally one-sided deal, or that I'd turned down the opportunity to go on a baseball date with a billionaire. For me, the lesson in that moment was that there's no shame in it for you if someone asks you out, or does something that makes you momentarily uncomfortable. Remember, you didn't do anything wrong. Of course it's okay, maybe even normal, to feel awkward. But you don't need to avoid the person forevermore, whatever you might think of him, as long as that person doesn't cross your line. Just try to maintain your boundaries and keep going. That guy and I both moved on from the failed pass, and it worked out well for everyone. It doesn't always. But in this case, he pivoted to the professional and we ended up with a productive working relationship. Circumstances change, people change, and relationships change. Sometimes for the better. Then again, sometimes they change for the worse. Peter and his wife separated, and in short order, half of his team of six separated from their spouses too, including me. It was an intense period of change in the company. We were obsessed with finding new revenues and opportunities, and there was a lot of travel and commuting to San Jose. Work became the priority over home. Some of us were thinking about having kids and wondering if our marriages could handle it if we did. For me, it was a hard call. A family with my husband would have been easy in so many ways. The economics of his firm were insane. They were taking in billions in annual management fees. Billions! A year! And they had a small team. And it was less risky than venture. Each head of the firm was probably taking home hundreds of millions of dollars annually. I wouldn't need any salary to survive, so I could be more flexible about what jobs I took. We'd have a nice home and a very secure, safe existence. More important, I knew he would make a great father. But there was some friction, and we had some fundamental differences. For instance, he wanted a predictable life with regular hours and a wife for whom he came first. We went to counseling for a while, but it didn't work. Our divorce was surprisingly easy and amicable. We did mediation, agreeing beforehand that any disputed money would go to charity. We didn't want to fight, which kept things simple. We were both earning a lot. And after a few short weeks, we were divorced. To help clear my head during the divorce, I went on a 2-week solo trip. My best friend from my law days, Daphne Sharir, had moved back to Tel Aviv, and I had always wanted to visit her. My soon-to-be ex-husband was always worried about safety and was uncomfortable with my going while we were married. I wasn't afraid, and once we were apart, I went to see my friend. I still remembered our pact to have kids on our own if we were single at 35. Suddenly, that was just a few years away and looking like a real possibility. It was rough in Israel that year, 2002, with so many terrorist attacks that people there seemed genuinely pleased to see an American tourist. And they really opened up to me. At the Yad Vashem Museum, people shared stories about the families they'd lost in the Holocaust. A woman seated next to me on the flight to Tel Aviv had survived a death march out of Auschwitz. 9 out of 10 of those Rose had walked with died. But she'd helped her sister survive. As Rose described her experiences, she frequently thanked God. "How can you still believe in God?" I asked her. "Because God saved me," she said. Stories like that put my divorce into perspective. While my mother was a practicing Catholic for much of my early childhood, I'd never been particularly religious. The whole trip was enlightening, especially traveling to Jerusalem. I visited places that were near mythical, including where the Last Supper was held and the actual stations of the cross. I saw the churches, temples, and mosques all standing in the same area with all the different groups,
Christians, Jews, Muslims, all so devoted to the same piece of land. Going to temple in Israel on Yom Kippur was so much more intense than when I'd gone in New Jersey to celebrate friends' bat mitzvahs. You weren't just sitting and listening to a religious figure. It was about praying. At the temple and at the Wailing Wall, I saw so much passion and seriousness and profound belief. I took some time to pause and reflect during my trip, to reassess my priorities. My interest in tech was rooted in my desire for our world to become more connected, more inclusive, kinder, gentler, and more fun. Technology was already changing the world, and the potential to reinvent education and access, information and communication, entertainment and media, and so much else seemed limitless. Spending time with open, optimistic people reminded me that it might be possible to fix some of what was broken in our country, particularly the deep divisions between the rich and poor and between those at the center and those at the margins. I felt renewed and excited. I remembered why I loved tech. When I got home, I felt, more than ever, committed to making a difference through my work. When I returned to BEA, I took a risk and started helping out another Skunkworks group. I joined Adam Bosworth's team to build a mobile group and product. After Danger, I had been convinced that mobile would change the world, and Adam wanted BEA to help make online businesses mobile. BEA had a web server to build and run complicated websites for computer browsers, and we were transforming it to work on cell phones. Unfortunately, Adam had a family member who became quite sick. He was running the group out of New York and wanted help managing the team while he was at the hospital. One of Adam's strengths was in making decisions and breaking down obstacles. I ran the team for him. I brokered conflicts between the engineering team and product lead, laid the groundwork to fire one of the team leads, and managed the effort for 6 months. During a reorganization, our budget was cut, and the team became demoralized. The constant turnover and reorganization at BEA started getting to me, too. It had been good in a lot of ways, but exhausting as well. If the company was not committed to moving to mobile, how innovative could it be? Adam decided to leave, and the team wanted to leave with him. I knew the product and team were highly valuable. Indeed, 2.5 years later, the company would be bought by Oracle for $9 billion. But it wasn't enough to keep me there, and I was also ready to leave in 2005. By then, a lot of good people were leaving or had left. There was so much opportunity everywhere else. I was getting recruited for various jobs, most significantly one at Google, where Adam and much of the team would go. Google's David Drummond, then General Counsel and VP of Corporate Development, was hiring in business development. I'd be working with Megan Smith, who later became the U.S. Chief Technology Officer, and Chris Sacca, who later found stardom as a billionaire investor on Shark Tank, as well as other soon-to-be powerful people. Google had just gone public on the NASDAQ stock exchange, and the company was clearly on the rise. But I didn't know if it was the right job for me. My biggest concern was that whenever I would ask at an interview, who runs the group I'd be in? Everybody gave a different answer. One person said I'd run it. One said no one would run it. Another person said Megan would run it. The organizational structure seemed unstable and political, which made me nervous. But I liked the intelligent way they solved problems, their metrics-oriented approach. And I really liked the people I would be working with, especially Salman Ullah, a friend from my web TV days, who had joined Google to run corporate development. At the same time, I was talking to Andy Rubin, who had left Danger by 2005. He was encouraging me to join his team at a new startup, Android. There were only 3 employees, and I did want to work for him again.
But Android was bought by Google just as we were negotiating my offer. In the middle of all this, as I was considering my options, I suddenly had an unlikely new prospect. A venture capital firm, of all things, saying, "Come join us and you'll discover the next Google." Chapter 6 Adventure Capital. One day, out of the blue, a friend sent me 3 pages of specs for a chief of staff position at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. At the time, Kleiner was one of the 3 most powerful venture capital firms in the world. The list of job requirements was almost comically long. An engineering degree, only in computer science or electrical engineering. A law degree and a business degree, only from top schools. Management consulting experience, only at Booz Allen or Bain. Startup experience, only at a top startup, for example, one funded by Kleiner, and only in corporate, business, or product development. Enterprise software experience, only at a big established company known for training employees, like Microsoft. Oh, and fluency in Mandarin. It was almost as if someone had copied my resume verbatim. It was so specific and unconventional, and it matched my unusual background exactly. It was nice to see the choices I made validated in that one job spec, even if my decisions had been more opportunistic than strategic. I went and met the recruiter, who acted as if he'd found a needle in a haystack. He immediately introduced me to John Doerr, the managing partner in need of a chief of staff. A chief of staff role varies, but involves helping someone important. John wanted his chief of staff to leverage his time, getting more out of every minute he worked. He valued his time at $200,000 per hour. So saving an hour or two a week meant a lot. He had one full-time assistant, Angela Valles, and several backups, so the chief of staff job was more on the investing than the administrative side. The position involved helping him prepare for meetings with research, speeches, or presentations, helping him make decisions around investing and hiring, sitting in on meetings to help drive actions, and giving him space to build the firm and enter new investment areas. When I interviewed with John, I liked him even more than when I had briefly met him at Telme. He was incredibly charismatic and a natural sales guy. So he was selling me on the job, the firm, and the team the whole time. People sometimes compare him to Woody Allen, because he's slight, wears glasses, stares intently, and has that strange mixture of nervous energy, nerdy charm, and awkwardness. Though John had the added persona of an unapologetic salesman. I was unconvinced that it was a good fit. "I'm running business development at a public company," I said. "I'm already pretty far along in my career. I have an opportunity to work at Google, or to join a growing startup. This seems like a step backward, or at most treading water." "No, no," he insisted. "We will make this into a really senior job. We're going to change it. It's going to be different. We'll be your family. You'll be able to learn and then be a venture capitalist yourself. Just do it for a year, and if you don't like it, we'll get you into one of our hottest startups. You won't regret it either way." "I really just don't know," I said. "I want to go back to a startup where I can build something amazing. I loved my time in startups. I want to get in earlier. VC seems like a detour from that path." I didn't tell him then, but I was also concerned about the culture. From what I'd gleaned, the traditional VC world had a formality about it that would be alien to me. I didn't know if I, coming from a middle-class immigrant family and preferring pizza with a few close friends to steak at 4-star restaurants with rock stars, would really enjoy it. I was board games and soda. Venture capitalists seemed to be poker and scotch. I saw it as a red flag. I deliberated on it long and hard, but finally turned down the job.
John went into full-fledged sales mode. He sent the internal recruiting partner, Juliette de Bovigny, a stylish British woman, to meet with me. We had a drink at the Four Seasons Bar in San Francisco. "Look, I appreciate your coming all the way up here," I told her. "Your time is valuable. John's time is valuable. I just don't want this job, and I don't want to waste your and John's time on it."
"Nobody will blame you if you don't take the job," Juliette responded.
"But you should really hear more about it. We're changing it. It's going to be better. It's a great opportunity. This role doesn't come up every day."
And so I met again with John, and he really pushed this whole idea that the job was going to be more senior. The job of the century.
Yes, officially I was going to be one of John's two chiefs of staff, but he promised I would rise quickly. I would be replacing Eileen Lee, the chief of staff helping John at the time, who was moving to an investing role, and we'd hire a second partner for the open role, which had been vacated by Matt Murphy much earlier. I would be able to look at investments with a VC who had first crack at the best ones in Silicon Valley.